This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. On today's show, marking 75 years since Pearl Harbor. First, many people who suffer from migraine headaches use painkillers to get some relief, but University of Cincinnati researchers have also confirmed that diet may play a big role in alleviating migraines. Here to talk about the link between diet and migraines are Director of the Headache Center at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Andrew Hershey, Co-Director of the Headache Center at Cincinnati Children's, Dr. Scott Powers, and Professor of Medicine and Director of the UC Headache and Facial Pain Center, Dr. Vincent Martin. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Andrew, Scott, and Vince, thank you so much for being here this afternoon. We appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Andrew, can you, what exactly is a migraine? How does this differ from your typical headache?
Well, first of all, from a headache expert, there's nothing such as a typical headache. Headache is more of a head pain. So there's some international guidelines that we use that can divide headaches into what we call primary headaches. Those are headaches that are intrinsically caused by the disease itself, and those that are secondary to something else. So migraine's a primary headache, meaning it's not really caused by anything else. And as such, it also has a strong genetic basis. In fact, upwards in some of the kids we see, it's 80 to 90% of the time we can identify one or more parents that also have migraines, even though they may not realize they have it. So what those criteria typically say is they're episodic disorders, although it can get to the point they're almost every day, usually associated with two or four features, a throbbing or pulsatile headache involving just part of the head. Most often in younger kids, it's across the front, while in older kids, it gets to the sides, and sometimes in adults, it's just one-sided. It should limit their activity or get worse with activity, and this is where the key point that a lot of people forget is that it's moderate to severe. In fact, more people have moderate headaches that are migraines than severe headaches. They can then be associated with either nausea or vomiting, and oftentimes are often associated with light and sound sensitivity.
What the term aura, what is that part of a migraine? What is the aura?
So aura is sort of a warning that you're going to get a migraine. It's a neurological change that does occur. Our criteria are actually going through some degree of modification, but using sort of the new suggestion that's coming out, it's usually associated with a positive symptom followed by a negative symptom. So 90% of people that get an aura get a visual aura. So for any of the listeners that have auras, they can easily recognize this. They'll start seeing flashing lights or wiggly lines or twinkling in a particular area of their visual field. And then anywhere between 5 and 60 minutes later, they start to get their typical migraine headache. But there's other types of auras, too, including a tingling followed by a numbness, which is a sensory aura, or one that's not necessarily an initial positive symptoms, but a trouble talking, something called a dysphasic aura, which if any viewers are interested, there's a good YouTube example of that about one of the reporters had that before the Grammys about 5 or 6 years ago that actually had a dysphasic aura captured on live television.
Scott, how debilitating are migraines?
You know, worldwide, migraines are about the eighth most disabling chronic illness of human beings. So it's not only a very prevalent condition, but it's also a very disabling condition, both because of the pain events and the impact of pain on daily function, but also in adults and children. If you have an intercurrent illness that creates pain, you can also have anxiety about when it's going to happen, some effect upon your life even between migraine attacks. So it's a very disabling and very prevalent chronic illness.
Do we have an idea how many people suffer from migraines?
It's about 36 million Americans suffer from
that
migraine
many.
Headaches, and yeah. It's about three times more common in women than men. And virtually every reproductive life event, like when menstrual periods first begin during adolescence, oftentimes that affects migraine, making it more frequent and more common. And then pregnancy has an effect, and even the menopause as well. So it's a disorder that actually changes throughout the life years.
Is there a certain age that suffers from this the most, or is it pretty widespread?
Well, actually, if you look at the data on how common it is, it peaks somewhere, you know, like around 40, 45. So, but initially when it first starts, it's pretty similar in terms of the proportion of girls and boys that have migraine up until the time when menstrual periods begin in women during adolescence. And then at that time, all of a sudden, women start having migraines more commonly than men. And then that curve never – the two curves never meet.
Andrew mentioned there's a genetic component to this. What are some other causes of migraine?
You headaches? Know, the other thing about the genetic, if you're born with it, as Ovind said, that peaks. The peak at 45 is when the decline sort of starts happening, but the increase actually occurs in the teen years. So, teens actually is when there's the most rapid gain of new people identifying them that they have migraines. So it actually is a disorder of teens and 20s. And then the disabling part starts to happen more in the 30s and 40s.
What about causes besides genetics? Do we know what else might be causing migraines?
Well, I think you need to differentiate between what causes and then what triggers the headache. So the cause in many cases might be a genetic disorder, which we haven't really fully elucidated. There are some genes that have been identified in a rare form of migraine where they get paralyzed on one side of their body. That's called hemiplegic migraine. And they've recently, through genetic studies, found some other gene mutations that might be associated with more common forms of migraine where you don't get paralyzed, because most patients do not get paralyzed as part of their aura with migraine. So the cause in many cases is probably a genetic, and many genetic causes have not been found yet. Then you have to ask what triggers headache, and there are just a variety of different things that can trigger individual attacks. And some of the biggies would be menstrual periods in women, particularly the falling estrogen levels that occur around the menstrual periods are a big trigger for about two-thirds of all women with migraine. In addition, other triggers would be things like weather. And here in Cincinnati, that's a very common, cause of headaches. In fact, I would say that and probably menstrual periods are probably the two most commonly reported triggers in adults. And the third one would be stress. Stress is also a very commonly reported trigger as well. But there's a variety of different dietary triggers, things like caffeine. Particularly if you don't consume caffeine for 24 hours or more, then you can have something called caffeine withdrawal headaches. There's monosodium glutamate, which might actually be overblown as a trigger. If it is a trigger, it's probably more of a trigger when in liquid form, like in a soup, as opposed to a food. And there are a variety of other things like gluten in individual patients that might trigger headache as well. So there's a variety of triggers that patients have, and really they have to kind of find these out on their own. They can keep a food diary or recognize triggers when they do come on.
Caffeine. Go ahead, Andrew.
I would have to say the trigger component is that there's a recent study that just came out using an app and identified that probably 70-80% of adults are wrong about their triggers. So being a focus on trigger sometimes is not the best way to do it. And Scott may be able to speak a little bit more on this, but oftentimes it's the psychological fear of an event that drives you to falsely identify something as a triggering mechanism. It's like that one time that you ate something and you got a headache the next day and say, well, that causes my headaches, when it's actually, if you approach things more scientifically, it's not. So you have to be very careful with identifying trigger and triggering-like mechanisms. And try to get to the biological process that's doing it. Such as skipping meals is actually probably a more consistent trigger than actually eating something in particular.
Scott?
Yeah, I think one of the things is every patient's different, and we try and take an individual history and look at how things are unfolding. But as Andrew alluded to, in a busy daily life, you can associate a lot of events to something when pain happens. So it's a little bit more of a detective work to figure out what your individual triggers might be. Stress, for example, is a common biological experience, and stress can occur both in a positive and a negative way. So a very exciting event has a physiological reaction that's not too different than a negative event. It's our perception of that event and our psychology of it that's important. A lot of people that have migraines do worry about having one at the bad, wrong time when they have other important things to do. So there's that worry. But if you look at careful diary studies where people track their migraines and their mood, it's generally not in the midst of something you consider stressful that the headache begins. It's usually the day after. It's commonly thought of as people like a letdown period, and then the migraine happens. As Vince alluded to, we're still trying to really uncover the underlying physiology of what might be occurring to someone who has a genetic predisposition for migraines. And it's not the really stressful day with your test or a job interview, it's the day after, and you're like, here it comes. So, as I said, everyone's an individual person, and part of our jobs is to really be partners with them to figure out how this is affecting their life. And then, as Andrew said, we try to work on things that are more to-do behaviors versus not-to-do behaviors. So don't skip meals. Eat regularly is the way we describe it, particularly with kids. Kids find it a lot easier to go do something than be told not to do something. It's just part of development. So eat regularly. Try and get regular sleep. Try and drink lots of liquids each day. Try and get regular exercise. Those are our four hallmarks of healthy behaviors. And we typically talk more about adding and doing when we talk about intervention that's more behavioral and lifestyle.
So stress reduction techniques, yoga, meditation, things like that, can those actually help with?
Yeah, pretty much any type of skill that you can apply that involves you becoming more relaxed at a physiological level. And as I said, everyone's different. So it could be as simple as deep breathing, which is a very fundamental technique. It could be more of an exercise-based thing like yoga, meditation, mindfulness. It kind of fits the developmental level and the individual aspects of the individual person. But any kind of thing that creates a relaxation state can be a way to prevent migraines from happening.
Vince, you mentioned not having caffeine can bring on a migraine headache. Mm-hmm. I find that interesting because I think it would be the opposite, that drinking too much caffeine might actually cause migraines.
Well, it's interesting that something that's as commonly consumed as caffeine, there have been a number of different studies, but there's still a lot that we need to know about how caffeine triggers headaches. We do know that if you consume more than about 400 or 500 milligrams of caffeine per day, it can bring on a lot of psychological symptoms like anxiety and depressive symptoms. Whether the high levels of caffeine actually bring on the headaches is really unknown when you drink it on a consistent basis. But there are a plethora, and I'm talking about 10 or 20 studies, that have looked at caffeine withdrawal. And as little as 100 milligrams of caffeine when consumed daily, and just this is not even in a headache patient. So if you consume it daily for 6 weeks and then you abruptly withdraw it, that can generate caffeine withdrawal symptoms, which include headache as well. So, and 100 milligrams of caffeine is less than what is typically in an 8-ounce cup of coffee per day.
So it sounds like a better way to do it if you're trying to avoid caffeine would be to wean yourself off of it as opposed to just stopping all at once.
Oh, absolutely. What I usually tell people is if someone's not really that severe, I would let them have maybe one or maybe 1.5 cups of coffee per day. But if they're drinking, you know, 5, 6, 7 cups of coffee per day, I'm going to ask them to kind of wean that down because I think, at least in my experience, that's been detrimental to headache patients.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to talk about migraine headaches and the link between diet and migraines are Dr. Andrew Hershey and Dr. Scott Powers from the Headache Center at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, and Dr. Vincent Martin with the UC Headache and Facial Pain Center. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Scott, are some people's brains just more sensitive? Does that come into play with migraines?
As we were talking about this being a neurological condition, a brain phenomenon, and having a genetic basis for most people, a lot of patients and families we talk to, that's one of the ways they sort of describe the experience. And if your brain's a little more sensitive to stimulation, one of the things we talk about when we talk about regular sleep, regular exercise, regular eating, if you can stay in a regular pattern, that tends to be something that can help prevent the migraine attacks from happening. It also means, particularly in our work with children, you know, activity pacing. When you get involved in so many clubs and you've got sports on the weekend and you're getting up early for Sunday school and you've got all these things on your plate, if you're a young person, and I'm sure it's true in adults as well, if you've got a really full life, that's great. If migraines interfere with that, we may have to work on sort of pacing yourself a little bit and not overdoing it and it's just part of a lifestyle adjustment many people with migraines make. It's very positive for them because they end up not having as many migraines, not having as much disability, but it's an adjustment just like we make with many things about our own physical health.
So, Andrew, it sounds like some people might have to be more regular and more consistent than other people in dealing with their migraines.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, as we talk about it, healthy habit component, and, you know, there's lots of things that can alter that imbalance. And there may be, again, getting back to the genetic aspect, it may be that people inherit one of the now up to 45 different genes that are potentially associated with migraines, or a composite of those. And then by falling out of good habits, they start to become hypersensitized. So even though something may not in the past have set off or triggered one of their headaches, once they're in that hypersensitized state, that it's, you know, easier to set off that next migraine. And by helping the people with the migraines learn how to sort of become desensitized, whether it's through yoga and relaxation, through healthy habit components, sometimes with the addition of medications. But it takes a whole sort of multidisciplinary component that involves different strategies to lower that sensitivity state. We can't really change the genes, but we can change how sensitive they might be.
I'd like to add one thing, is that I often tell patients, for example, that half of migraine management is what they do with their lives. So only half of it's medication and half of it's lifestyle. So they really have to take an effort to really change their habits. If they're obese, then we might actually have them lose weight. That can make a big difference in some patients. And a lot of times, smoking, which in some patients might trigger headaches, drinking too much caffeine, et cetera. We try to get them to exercise. So it's a whole program that we put together to manage their headaches.
So, Vince, the research that's been done on the link between diet and migraines, what is the connection between the two things? What are we finding through this research?
Well, one thing that Andrew had mentioned earlier was that sometimes when you think about diet as a trigger, if you're trying to identify one specific ingredient out of hundreds in every food that you have, it can be difficult to really identify, say, in some cases, whether MSG, for example, is a trigger or some other triggers that are pretty ubiquitous in foods. But there have been some new diet studies that are very, very interesting. One is a diet that has certain kinds of fatty acids. It's kind of a fat in the body. And there's something called omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory. And there's omega-6 fatty acids that are pro-inflammatory. And a diet that increases the anti-inflammatory omega-3s and one that decreases the omega-6s was shown in one study of patients with chronic headache to almost be as effective as Botox, which we commonly use for headache. They decreased headache by about 8 days per month in those patients. And it was a very, very well-done study out of North Carolina. So that's one diet. And when you think about the foods that are high in omega-3s, it's just certain kind of fish. So it's like salmon, cod, haddock, and sardines. And certain kind of oils are high in omega-6s, the bad ones. So you kind of avoid, you know, canola oil and safflower oil and eat more olive oil. And then even peanuts, like cashews, have high omega-6s, which you don't like. Regular peanuts that are high in omega-6s. So it's a very specific diet to maximize the anti-inflammatory and minimize the pro-inflammatory fatty acids.
Will fish oil supplements, omega-3 supplements, will those do the same thing, or is it better to use food as your source for omega-3?
Well, it's interesting. They've done studies looking at just supplementing, you know, with these omega-3s in pills, and it was not effective in preventing migraines. So there's something about maximizing one through diet and minimizing the other fatty acid that's pro-inflammatory that seems to be the answer. So that's one diet. And then there's other diets too. For example, there's a diet where you identify an immune response in your body by something called IgG antibodies. And there now are two of three studies suggested those were effective in reducing the frequency of migraines. So it's a blood test that you do, and it identifies a very specific immune response to food. And then you try to eliminate that food from the diet. And in one study, there was about a 26% reduction in the frequency of headaches. And then there's a gluten issue. Gluten is a big fad, and probably a lot of people eliminate gluten when they probably don't have to. But there now are some new blood tests that can be done to identify people with celiac disease. And at least in some non-controlled studies, it suggests that the frequency of migraine might decrease in those people.
We had an email from Susan who says that her 9.5-year-old daughter has suffered from abdominal migraines. for a little over a year. And she's wondering if you can confirm if this research is helpful for both head and abdominal migraines. So, Andrew, you first off, you want to address, I'd never heard of an abdominal migraine before. Can you address that for us?
Well, an abdominal migraine is basically thought of as a migraine but without the head pain. So this is where people have to be very careful. If the kids may have a lot of nausea or vomiting or abdominal symptoms but aren't asked or don't come forthcoming that their head hurts at the same time, then they may be diagnosing abdominal migraine and, in fact, it is migraine. Beyond that, there does seem to be, and I'm hedging a little bit because the studies out there are somewhat lacking, but these recurrent abdominal symptomatology that has a high correlation with migraine, and it starts much earlier than even that. There's been some studies that have showed infantile colic or episodic colic that occurs in infancy is actually a precursor to migraines. There's this recurrent abdominal symptoms or recurrent vomiting symptoms that are sometimes labeled abdominal migraine that later evolve into migraines. And then some portion of people get something called cyclic vomiting syndrome where they actually will vomit on a set schedule, like every 21 days they'll have a full day of vomiting. And those are probably all of a spectrum of abdominal symptomatology that have a much higher correlation with people also having migraines. So, and if you look at the long-term projection of a lot of these children that have these symptoms, the symptoms that they originally brought forth seem to resolve, yet as they get older, they start to have the much more typical migraine symptomatology.
And one of the ways that I work with children about this is we do drawings and we talk about how our body works. There's a lot about learning how your body works in terms of being able to control some of your symptoms. And in early development, the tissues of the stomach, the neural tube, and the brain kind of all embryonically come from similar places. So as you're, in a way that I try to explain to young people, it may be that the pain you're experiencing is more in your belly at this point, but we sort of think of it as a total package that might be happening. As Andrew said, as you get older, you might have more headache pain and less belly pain. The treatments we use for relaxation, healthy habits, confidence in being able to help yourself get better, those treatments that are more behaviorally oriented are effective in recurrent abdominal pain, in migraine pain, as well as someone who might be evolving into more of a head pain part of migraine, as this 9.5-year-old might be. But certainly the experience from the child perspective is it hurts and I'd like to feel better. So our job is to help them find ways to improve that experience.
Tracy from Oakley called. She wanted to know if you could talk about vestibular migraines and any research on that.
Vestibular migraines are attacks of vertigo. So vertigo either is a sensation that you're moving, the room is spinning, or that you're moving in relationship to the room. And there are no formal diagnostic criteria for vestibular migraine, but there's some proposed criteria, and one requires that about 50% of the attacks actually occur along with a typical migraine attack, or they have migraine-associated features like sensitivity to light, noise, or nausea with this. It's something that occurs very, very commonly in migraine patients. There's not a lot of data on how to treat it, but I can tell you that in the adult headache program at UC, we get referred a lot of patients with this diagnosis of vestibular migraine. And just anecdotally, we've put a lot of these people on migraine preventatives. And what's interesting is that, at least in our experience, both the migraine attacks decrease as well as the attacks of vertigo.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And Vince, so it sounds like when we talk about triggers, so one form of diet might be excluding certain things. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about what diets are composed of, eating certain things to reduce. Am I understanding that distinction right?
Yeah, there's something called elimination diets where if you can identify what dietary triggers you might have, then you could actually avoid them. Some are pretty easy to recognize. Like, you know, if someone comes up and punches you in the face 10 times, you can be pretty sure the 11th time that guy's going to punch you in the face again. By the same token, if you drink a beer and 10 straight times you get a migraine attack, you don't need an app to tell people that they're having a migraine. That's just common sense. But a lot of the other triggers that are more, all of the other substances that are, like if you look at sodium content in foods, is that triggering headache? No one's going to be able to pick that out usually by themselves. So it depends on what kind of trigger that you're really talking about.
And then I guess the research has been geared toward these diets, what they're composed of as far as whether they're beneficial
yes.
for migraine sufferers.
Okay, so there's elimination diets where you can identify it. And there isn't now a new app out by the group called Curlator where they actually can, they actually statistically prove whether a given food might actually trigger headache. So there is an app out on the market for that now. But the other one is our comprehensive diets. These are diets that actually, you know, try to give you substances in your diet that might actually be preventing headaches. Or the chemicals or substances are so ubiquitous in the diet, you're never going to be able to pick that out and try to eliminate it. So one would be a low-fat diet, basically where you reduce the amount of fats in the diet. Another one would be there's some studies suggesting that a low-sodium diet may benefit people that have what they call pre-hypertension. There was a study where they looked at something called the DASH diet, which is like a Mediterranean diet. And they also eliminated salt. And if they were pre-hypertensive, so if they were predisposed, if they had high, you know, borderline high blood pressures, those patients had less frequent headaches as well.
We got a question from Dana, who's 55, wondering about hormonal triggers. She says she wakes up with a migraine 3 or 4 times a week. Any thoughts on what's going on here or why?
I can answer that. That's something I've done a fair amount of research on. But there probably are a number of different ways that hormones can either trigger or in some cases even prevent headache. I think we already mentioned the menstrual migraines. Those are migraines that occur anywhere from 2 days before to 3 days after the onset of the menstrual period. And we think primarily that it's the dropping or falling levels of estrogen that occur around the menstrual period that actually trigger the headaches. But there's another subgroup of girls and women that are menstruating, they'll develop mid-cycle headaches. And it's at that time, too, in the mid-cycle where there's a slight dip in estrogen, and there probably are other hormonal things that might be triggering headaches. And there's also periods of the menstrual cycle where they may actually prevent headaches, like when the progesterone levels in the latter half of the menstrual cycle are high and less fluctuating, that might actually be preventative for migraine.
Teddy emailed. He says he's been a lifelong migraine sufferer. He's been taking preventive medicines for 7 years. He says he recently stopped taking the medications, and he feels better, and he's not restarted. So he's wondering if anybody has any idea why, what might be going on here.
Well, I think people have to think about the fact that they're not changing their genes. So once that hypersensitivity I was talking about earlier is resolved, they really should go off their prevention medications. The other thing that I think the caveat is, I mean, you said 7 years on the medication, that was way too long. Even the longest adult studies are hard-pressed to say that more than 6 to 12 months is needed. And if you're going for more than 6 to 12 months and have not reached adequate control, meaning less than about one headache a week or so, then you need to be seeking out other treatment options and modalities to be able to make that better. So I would speculate what's happened with Eddie.
Teddy.
That his headaches actually had probably responded much earlier on, and once he ran out, he just didn't need to be on it anymore, and he sort of went through the self-appropriate process of getting off of prevention that he didn't need any longer.
I mean, we talk to young people quite a bit about this because their question is, okay, is this me forever?
Is this going to be a lifelong thing?
What we talk about is that you probably have the predisposition for your lifetime because there's a genetic basis, particularly if you're a girl, as Vince talked about. But how you manage your headaches, what you may need to do to keep them under control at different parts of your life may go up and down, may take more energy sometimes and less energy others. And it's really that sense of, I have something I can do to control this illness. I have a plan. When I use my plan, it's effective. You can start to see how that builds confidence and momentum, that even though this may be an intermittent pain condition, it's not controlling me. I have the skills to control it, and that's a big part of what we talk to young people about.
Kirsten had a question for us, and she wondered if exercise can be a trigger. She says she often gets severe headaches a few hours after she does one of these boot camp-style workouts.
Exercise is a fairly common trigger for migraine. In fact, there's something called exercise-induced headaches. And usually they're rather short-lived and occur with vigorous exercise, but really any kind of exercise can do it. So you could get it with running, or you could get it with lifting weights or other activities.
And
go ahead, Andrew. Separate. It's not exercise-induced headache is a different type of headache than migraine. Now, migraine itself, if you get dehydrated from your exercise, not making adequate hydration, that you could potentially be causing a dehydration triggering point of your migraine. Additionally, exercise is an important treatment modality for migraines, and this comes out of some very recent studies that look at a new compound. It's actually an old compound, but new treatments that are coming about are for CGRP. And CGRP is thought to help regulate migraines, and with regular exercise, you actually improve your CGRP levels. So regular exercise should be a key component in your treatment modality for migraines. And if you every time you exercise, you get a headache, then not think beyond migraines and potentially see someone more expert in the headache field to say, do you have something else going on? Because there could be concerns of a vascular disorder or some other mechanism, an endocrine disorder that could be causing this problem and not necessarily be migraines.
And that goes back to the importance of every patient is unique and different. So it's a partnership with them to say, if you're in seeing this pattern, let's talk about what coping skills we could do. What could we do to make the event of the headache not happen without totally eliminating things from your life that we know that are positive? So you certainly don't have that experience every time you go to boot camp, you get a headache. But there's many ways I think we can adequately hydrate, good rest, and see what particular aspects of coping skills could help an adult or a child not have the headache, but engage in the more healthy activities and activities we know that are treatments as well.
Scott, it sounds like from what you're saying, it's treating migraines is it's a tricky thing. There's just no one particular answer to these.
Yeah, I think you get an illness that's affecting 10% of the population that's genetically based, experienced differently at different parts of the lifetime. By definition, there's not going to be an easy answer, and there's going to be an individualized answer. So the studies we've described today and others people can go look at give us clues as to what the best strategies are. But as practitioners, it's our job to help partner with patients so that their particular strategy is the most effective for them. So the relationship that a patient with migraine has with their primary care provider, their neurologist, a psychologist, whoever's on their team, we find that's a very key component of managing what is basically a chronic illness over the lifespan.
Vince, where does the research go from here? Is there more to come on researching this link between diet and migraines?
Well, most of the studies so far have been relatively small, so I think more large-scale studies need to be done. But it's something that patients ask about all the time. It's one of the most frequent questions. How can I eat right? How can I try to prevent my headaches with diet? And I think that that certainly future large-scale studies need to be done.
Andrew, Scott, and Vince, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you.
Director of the Headache Center at the Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Dr. Andrew Hershey, co-director of the Headache Center at Cincinnati Children's, Dr. Scott Powers, and professor of medicine and director of the UC Headache and Facial Pain Center, Dr. Vincent Martin. Coming up, marking 75 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor, this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.